Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake, here with John Wells. Our first guest this morning is the New York Times bestselling author, the prolific Simon Winchester. He has written many books, including The Professor and the Madman, The Map That Changed the World, and others. And he joins us today to talk about his new book called The Perfectionists, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. Winchester traces the development of technology from the industrial age to the digital age to explore the single component crucial to advancement. And that is, he says, precision. The rise of manufacturing, he says, could not have happened without an attention to precision. At the dawn of the Industrial Revolution in 18th century England, standards of measurement were established, giving way to the development of machine tools. So those machines that make machines. Simon Winchester, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
Wonderful to have you. So you start off in your prologue with a little conversation about your father, the precision engineer, and he brings home one day these metal plates that were like magic to you. Can you tell us that story?
Yes, I was about eight, I think. It must have been early 1950s, cold and foggy London. And he brought back, he often brought things back from his factory where he made tiny electric motors for the Royal Navy for the guidance systems of torpedoes. And on this particular day, he brought this rather beautiful wooden box with a little brass nameplate on with his name on top, and opened it up, put it on the dining room table, and in it were something more than 100, I think 103, in fact, beautiful, highly polished steel, ranging from cubes down to little slivers of steel, all with a little number, 0.375 or 0.712 or something like that on them. And he took two of them out, two of the largest ones, and put them on the tablecloth, which gave my mother a conniption because my mother was from Belgium and made lace, and she was very proud of her white lace tablecloth. And my father was always putting oily things on the table to her great annoyance. So she left and left the two of us to look at these little steel things, and he first showed me that they weren't magnetic by pushing them towards each other, and they didn't either attract or repel one another. And then he put one on top of the other and said, okay, young boy, take the top one off. And I picked it up, and the bottom one came with it. And I thought that was a bit odd because we have just decided they weren't magnetic. So I held the bottom one down and pulled the top one. I couldn't make it budge at all. It was firmly stuck to the other one. And my father said, this is what I wanted to show you, because it's easy to separate them. You just slide them apart. And he slid it across the other one, and the two separated. But he said, the reason that they're so firmly attached is that they are perfectly, perfectly flat. There are no little asperities in the surface that would let air in and make it weak. The two surfaces are so flat that the molecules actually bond together, and the two pieces of metal very briefly become one. And that introduced me, I think, to a concept in precision engineering which is absolutely crucial to it, and that's making things which are impeccably, perfectly flat.
Mm. And that, although you were just a 7 or 8 year old boy, you've carried with throughout your life that story and the concept, the first exposure to precision, to perfection in machines, really. And, you know, I think it's something that we sort of take for granted, the precision that surrounds us, that enables so many mechanisms to function, and really everything, well, as I said, everything surrounding us. How is it that we take it for granted?
Well, I was first sort of apprised of this by a stranger. A lot of people write to me and say, I think you should write a book about this or the other. But this called Colin Povey, who was a scientific glassblower who lived in Florida and who I'd never heard of, never had any contact with. He wrote to me one day and books, and he rather liked them, which was nice. Why didn't I write a book about the history of precision, which was invisible, like the oxygen we breathe or the language we speak? We take it very much for granted. And yet it's totally essential, but it had a beginning, and we don't know where it's going to go to, but it's an extraordinary thing that fascinated him. And I suddenly thought, my gosh, with my father, just hold on a second, with my father's obsession with precision and also one or two other things, I used to have a very good association for journalistic reasons, not because I could afford them, but with Rolls-Royce motor cars. And I came to go to the Rolls-Royce factory fairly often and see the kind of things that they're producing there, which were high, high precision pieces of kit. And I thought Colin Povey's right, and so I set about researching it. But the problem was, at least from a literary point of view, is what's the narrative thrust of the book? I didn't want it to be a series of sort of episodic chapters. It needed to have a narrative thrust, and that came to me really in one of those wonderful sort of epiphany moments when I was looking at the very beginnings of precision and the first thing ever made, which was in 1776, which was a cylinder for one of James Watt's steam engines, and that had a tolerance of the thickness of an English shilling, which was 0.1 of an inch. And having that number suddenly made me realize the narrative thrust of this book, because the early chapters could be things that were 0.1, and a later chapter could be 0.001, and then 0001, and all the rest of it, right up to things of astonishing precision today. And there are four, oddly enough, also cylinders made of fused silica rather than iron, which mm-hmm. is what the early cylinders were made of, which have a tolerance of 0.0 and then 28 zeros and then a 1. And so this gave me the narrative flow of the book. So it's invisible, and yet if you look at it carefully, it's very visible indeed.
Simon, I was brought up in the New England area outside of Boston.
And that's where I am.
Okay. And, you know, we had a number of rivers, including the Merrimack River, that had so much to do with the Industrial Revolution here in our country. They were lifting water and moving it. They were running their textile mills at the mouth of the Merrimack River in Newburyport, Massachusetts. They had a shipbuilding industry and all those sorts of things. So sort of a history, it was a real interest to me. But I had never heard about John Iron Mad Wilkinson, and and your story is absolutely fascinating, first of all, for his accomplishments, but I also appreciate it that the guy was an absolute character. And maybe you can take a minute and tell us about Iron Mad's contribution to the Industrial Revolution.
Yes, indeed. Well, basically what happened is that James Watt, who I think everyone will probably remember from school, was the inventor of the proper working steam engine. So he had a factory in the English Midlands in the middle of the 18th century, and he was trying as hard as he could to make steam engines that were efficient, but they weren't, because the way they made cylinders in those days was to take a sheet of iron and hammer it and hammer it and hammer it until it turned into a circle, weld the two edges together, turn it vertically, lower the piston into it. But the piston rattled about in this thing like a pea on a drum, and steam went everywhere. The thing was highly inefficient. Well, about 70 miles away from where James Watt's factory was this fellow called John Wilkinson, whose name continues today. Wilkinson sword razor blades are still made. And he had iron on his land, had a sort of iron mine, and became fascinated from his teenage years with iron and what you could do with it. And he did all sorts of what today are mundane things, but in those days were extraordinary things. He had a desk built of iron, he had a table made of iron, he had a boat made of iron. He had a coffin made of iron, and this was before the Me Too movement, and he used to lie in his coffin in his workshop, and if comely young ladies would come up to visit, he would leap out of his coffin, a joke of the 18th century joke, I suppose, and startle them. And he's now buried in that coffin under an iron obelisk. So iron defined the man, but the important thing that he did was that he was making cannons for the Royal Navy. And he was doing so by drilling, once again, it sounds awfully mundane, but by today's standards, but it was revolutionary by 18th century standards. He would get a big chunk of iron and drill a hole in it with a drill that remained very, very stable, so that the hole it drilled was absolutely straight, and the diameter of the hole, the same diameter, the whole length of the hole that was drilled. So he wanted to buy one of Watt's steam engines, so he as it were, rang him up, or whatever the 18th century equivalent of getting in touch with someone 70 miles away was. And Watt came over with a steam engine, all the bits and pieces, and assembled it. And Wilkinson said, this is useless. It's completely inefficient. Steam goes everywhere. The cylinder doesn't fit properly. Let me make you a cylinder. And using exactly the same techniques that he used for making the cannon, he made a cylinder for James Watt. He put it vertically. He lowered the, and it's a very big thing, about 30 inches in diameter, lowered this enormously heavy piston into it, and it fitted like a hand in a glove. And suddenly, there was no leakage of steam, and when all the bits and bobs were assembled, the engine chuffed magnificently, the flywheel turned, the rods and connecting rods and the governor all started spinning, and we had the first ever efficient steam engine. And Watt said, this is amazing, this has changed everything, I will order 500 of them. So he had Wilkinson, who was mad maybe, but he was awfully pleased to get an order for 500 cylinders. And with that, it can fairly be said that the Industrial Revolution was off to the races, because that was 1776, same year as America was founded, mm-hmm. May the 4th. Oddly enough, I didn't know this until someone told me when I was on my book tour, May the 4th is Star Wars Day. So precision was born on May the 4th of May the 4th be with you. So it's an important day, an easy one to remember, but it's all thanks to this rather lunatic, amusing fellow.
And you say it's kind of straightforward and simple, but when you actually read that particular chapter, it's just a fascinating story. So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is it's very interesting that two people from two completely different disciplines, you've got Watt, who has reimagined a steam device into a steam engine, and then you get someone who's building cannons, which had so much to do with sea power, because cannons would blow up if they weren't, you know, solid steel. I mean, there were a lot of challenges with that, and they could take one of Wilkinson's cannons and put it on any boat and take a standard size cannonball, and it was going to fit, and it was probably not going to blow up. But you get these two different people together, one that reimagines the steam device and one that reimagines what to do with iron, and together they basically change the world.
You're so right, and there are so many connections like this. I mean, I know we don't have a great deal of time, but I mean, one of the devices that followed it was, and if you'll just allow me, indulge me for a moment, prior to the Industrial Revolution, most of England's wealthy people lived in the countryside. They lived in big mansions. They lived in castles. They felt secure because they had fences and walls and hedges surrounding their properties. Then came the Industrial Revolution. People started making fortunes in cities, built themselves big houses. They were now very wealthy, but living in cities. And in cities, if you have rich people living close to people that weren't so rich, that brought about envy. And envy brings about crime, as we all know only too well. So these rich people built themselves very strong houses with very strong front doors, secured by unbreakable locks. And the people, it's commonly thought that following Wilkinson and cannons and cylinders for steam engines, the next things that were made in the story of precision were clocks and guns. And they were indeed made. But the really most important thing, and it's socially important, was the development of very secure and intricate and very, very precise locks. And the man who made those, the man called Joseph Brummer, was assisted by another fellow called Henry Maudslay. And this is rather like you've just said about the coming together of people from unlikely disciplines. Henry Maudslay was the man that invented the concept of flatness that I mentioned a few moments ago. And he did many, many other things, but he also created the first assembly line in the world, and that assembly line was not obviously for the production of cars, but for the production of wooden pulley blocks for Royal Navy sailing ships. An average sailing ship needed about 1,300 of these huge elmwood blocks, which you pass ropes through and enable you to lift the sail or the anchor or whatever. And he made a factory with 43 iron machines powered by James Watt's steam engines, that was the first in the world. And so well made were these machines, which were made in about 1790, that they were still running in Portsmouth in England in 1965. And they're still there. They're just not running because we don't need pulley blocks anymore. But that was the first true production line, long before, you know, we got cars or sewing machines or bicycles. And it still exists and was still running until half a century ago.
Wow. Pretty incredible. You can also see the evolution of precision when you look at some of these early innovators. Joseph Brahma, for example, was not only a lock maker, but he was a cabinet maker, and he worked with engines. And I found that quite interesting, that today you would never have someone that whose innovations and areas of expertise are so varied.
Well, he was extraordinary. I mean, he invented the first flush toilet.
Huh.
He invented a machine for counting banknotes. And every time you go into a bank and see that little thing fluttering away, he invented that. He invented the fountain pen. But covering his bets, just in case the fountain pen didn't become popular, he invented a machine for making quills for writing, you know, with a quill pen. Mm-hmm. In large numbers, and he also invented the beer engine that enabled beer to be pulled up in the bar without the poor barman having to go down to the cellar every couple of hours to bring up a new barrel. So every time you go to a pub and you order a pint of draft beer, you must bless Joseph Brahma for being the man that allowed that to happen.
We'll make sure we do that. So if you're just joining us, our guest is Simon Winchester. He is the author of a new book called The Perfectionist, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. And in the case of Henry Royce and Henry Ford, the precision in making the Rolls-Royce versus the Model T, it allowed them both to exist, but that precision is very different. One is spare no expense. The other one is the goal was to make cars as cheaply as possible. How do those two things work together or differently?
Well, it's a very interesting phenomenon here. This was how precision took two very different routes all at about the same time, about 1907, which is when the Rolls-Royce Silver Ghost was born. And they made 8,000 of those, 3,000 of them in Massachusetts, which John will appreciate. The Model T Ford, made in Michigan, same length of time, 1907 to 1928, they made 16 million of those. And the difference as far as precision was concerned, that the Rolls-Royce was handmade, and so if two bits of metal didn't quite fit, the man who was making them simply took a file and filed away some excess metal until they did fit. But in a production line, making millions of cars inexpensively, and that's the key, and not by hand, but by machine, the key components were all, and this is crucial to engineering, interchangeable parts, thousands and thousands of parts, all exactly the same. Every carburetor, every piece of transmission, every gear wheel, identical one to the other. So they were all, if you can imagine the production line, all the cars going past, the workers in front of them, and the hoppers up above containing all these intricately made pieces of metal which were going to be assembled to make the car, all of them interchangeable, all of them made to exactly the same dimensions and specifications. If one of the parts was not correctly made, came down into the production line, suddenly the production line would stop. And everyone, all the workers, would stand around smoking and grumbling and waiting for it to start again while the inspectors worked out which bit didn't fit. And it would cost thousands of dollars. And so, in a way, precision was much more important to the making of mass-manufactured things like cars and making them cheaply than it was for the making of handmade objects like Rolls-Royce motor cars. And one of the advantages was that mass manufacturing made things a lot cheaper. If you bought a Model T in 1907, it would cost you $850. If you bought it in 1927, it would cost you $219. So Henry Ford's dream of opening all of America to the common man and woman was realized by making this car, something Rolls-Royce never, never wanted nor ever achieved.
Well, let's talk about an application for interchangeable parts. certainly the one that you just mentioned that could cost thousands of dollars and shut down a plant floor. I mean, that's expensive. There's a cost to that. But let's talk about winning wars. I mean, you talk in the book about the flint rifle, and let's say George Washington's army is, well, there was a tremendous failure rate of guns. So one soldier might have a gun at the trigger was broken. One soldier might have a gun where the flint mechanism was broken. And there was no way that they could fix them. They'd have to send the gun back or get a new gun. Interchangeable parts in the gun industry would allow the soldier or the army to be able to quickly repair their own guns, and it could mean the difference between winning and losing a war.
You're absolutely right. And this, oddly enough, was, I say oddly enough, I suppose it's rather chauvinist of me to say that, but it was invented in France, not in Britain, which was the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution. The key figure here, long forgotten, was called Honoré Blanc. And he looked at a flintlock, and the mechanism for a flintlock has about 10 pieces with curious names like the frizzle and the pan and the lock and the striker and the trigger. The trigger, of course, is familiar. He decided that if you made all these pieces perfectly interchangeable, then if, as you say, in the heat of battle, a soldier breaks his trigger or the flintlock mechanism itself snaps, he merely goes to the armorer and says, can I have another trigger? Can I have another flintlock? And he'd snap it in, and it would work perfectly 5 minutes later. This, when Honoré Blanc devised this idea, he called in all the great and the good of Paris to look at what he had done. He basically had a series of boxes with 100 triggers and 100 flints and 100 this, that, and the other, and said, take any one and assemble a flintlock mechanism yourself. And people did, with great success. Well, one of the people in the audience was Thomas Jefferson, who was the American minister to France at the time. And he got it. I mean, this is another example of Jefferson's astonishing intelligence and prescience. He said, this is the way America's going to manufacture her guns and many other things, too. So he wrote a letter to the Secretary of War in Washington saying, I've seen this extraordinary demonstration. We must do the same thing in our armories in Springfield in Massachusetts and in Harper's Ferry in Virginia. And who, that's what the Secretary of War said, who would like to get a contract to make guns using this technique? One of the people that raised his hands was Eli Whitney, who was famous for making the cotton gin, although not rich because he had never patented it. So he said, yes, I can do this. Well, the extraordinary thing is, far too long a tale to tell in detail, he put on a demonstration down at Harper's Ferry for the great and the good of Washington. But he cheated. He didn't produce anything with interchangeable parts. He just pulled the wool over everyone's eyes. He hoodwinked them. And they said they didn't understand what was going on. They said, yes, okay, we'll give you the contract. Gave him the contract. All his guns were 8 years late, and none of them worked properly. So although to most American children today, Eli Whitney is a hero, to the engineering community, he's a charlatan, a crook, and a rogue, and a man that deserves to be remembered with opprobrium.
While we're giving the French credit for the interchangeable gun and the parts and those sorts of things, let's just throw one more nod out to the French. If it wasn't for the French, the Wright brothers would not have experienced the success that they did, because it was the French that really put them up on a pedestal and really talked about and had them come out with their flying machines to show the world what they could do, because our government did not. And that was in David McCallum's book, The Wright Brothers. And,
right.
So we'll give the French a little more credit.
We ought to, yes. And my mother was Belgian, so I have a sort of Gallic solidarity here.
Okay.
Very good. Well, with every advancement in technology and innovation, everything that precision allowed, we're always going to have those who are reluctant to move forward. And, you know, to this day, we use that term, a Luddite, those of us who don't have the latest and greatest technology, and we say that we're going to stick with our flip phone or whatever it is. But most of us don't know where that came from. Take us back to 1811 or so in the Northern Midlands in the UK. Luddism. And Nell Ludd, it's the movement's leader there. Talk about that.
Yeah, it was actually Ned Ludd. I mean, he was a man rather than a lady. But he, basically, that was all to do with stocking frames. These were devices which helped mass manufacture stockings. And he noticed, not unreasonably, that by having machines do the work, so the craftsmen and women that made these stockings were thrown out of work. And so they began an orgy of machine breaking, and which was a crime in those days, and so serious a crime that indeed it was a capital offense, and some people were hanged as a result of it. But more generally, this is a phenomenon which, as you rightly say, continues to this day with people wanting to stick to flip phones. But one can understand it in a way. I mean, I mentioned a few moments ago the production line for these pulley blocks in Portsmouth, this remarkable, excuse me, for this remarkable factory. That factory, before it existed, pulley blocks for the Navy required the labors of hundreds, if not the low thousands, of craftsmen who made these pulley blocks in little carpentry shops all over southern England. All of a sudden, with the introduction of this factory, the Royal Navy had no need for craftsmen, and there were simply 10 men, unskilled men, with lubricating oil bottles that went around lubricating the machines. And all of a sudden, thousands of craftsmen were put out of work. And this was one of the byproducts of the Industrial Revolution and indeed of the growth of precision, that it did away with craftsmanship. And I linger long in this book of mine about the social consequences of precision and possibly too much worship of precision, whereby the craftsman is becoming sidelined and we just worship titanium and we ignore, let's say, bamboo, if you like. And I very much admire countries like Korea and Japan. Even those are countries well known for precision, you know, with Samsung and Canon and Nikon and so forth. But they, to this day, are so reverent in their attitude to craftsmanship that they award the title of living national treasure to people, usually quite elderly people, who have spent their life devoted to the making, doing carpentry or ceramics or lacquerware, and make beautiful, beautiful things by hand. And it's something which I very much admire Japan and Korea for doing. And I'm afraid that perhaps in the United States and in Britain and in Europe, our reverence for precision is so much that we're turning our backs to an extent on the joys of the imprecise and of craftsmanship.
Mm, that's an interesting point. And yet there is a proliferation of things like farmers markets and and Etsy, for example, the site where you're able to upload your little craftsman shop products. And so that's interesting. I think that obviously it's not coming full circle, because we will never give up what precision engineering has allowed us in advancement. But you know, I think we're growing to appreciate both.
I hope so. And also, another what to me seems interesting is, are we reaching limits in precision? I mean, mechanical precision now, there was a celebrated incident, a near horrible accident involving a massive Airbus aeroplane, a Qantas plane, going from Singapore to Sydney recently, where the engine blew up in spectacular fashion, all because of the mismachining by a fraction of a millimeter of one tiny tube in the heart of the plane. The kind of thing that makes you think, are the commercial requirements of the engines we're making now such that we're reaching the limits of our ability to make parts as small as we do? And similarly in electronics, I mean, our cell phone, for instance, if you have an iPhone 8, say, the chip at the heart of that, an Apple A11 made in Taiwan, has 4.3 billion transistors in it. A transistor, which, if you remember, was made in, 1948? First one was about the size of your hand. Mm-hmm. Now they're so tiny. And indeed, the statistic that completely rocked me back on my heels was the knowledge that there are now more transistors in the world than there are leaves on all the trees in all the world. A phenomenal number. And they're so tiny, 13 trillion new ones are made every day. They're so tiny, they're operating down at atomic levels, where things start behaving in a very peculiar fashion. So both in the mechanical and the electronic sense, one wonders whether we're beginning to reach the limits of precision.
Fascinating point. The book is The Perfectionists, How Precision Engineers Created the Modern World. Our guest is Simon Winchester. Thanks for joining us today on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, Simon.
Thank you.